History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a couple of very simple steps. If we take the initiative to ask a few questions and then employ enough patience to listen, we might just be amazed by some of the long buried memories that start to emerge once again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I expect that to be the case again today in New Canaan, Connecticut, a town of a little more than 20,000 people, famous for the architecture of some of its mansions and the who's who of residents that counts famous entertainers, politicians, sports figures, and journalists, among others. But I don't think there's anybody in New Canaan I'd rather sit down for an hour with than 96-year-old Frank Gallo. And by the time we're done today, maybe you're going to feel the same way. Frank served in the 78th Infantry Division during World War II. But as always, we're going to start out a little earlier on with his childhood in Stamford, Connecticut, about 10 miles from where he lives now.
At that time, with the Depression, and our family didn't have any money at all. My father, during the war, got a job at Luders Marine in Stamford, making 20 bucks a week. I went to high school with a trade school course and went to trade school. But when I became 16, I had to quit to go to work for help the family. So I was taking up printing. I went to Condé Nast, making $18 a week for 37 and a half hours. Gave my mother $10 and I kept $8. And that's how it was. And then when I became 18, in February, I was drafted in April and combat in December, 44.
Just like that. And I want to ask you a little more about that, just because this is so foreign to so many people now. I mean, a lot of kids grow up with a smartphone in their hand. I would love to hear what your childhood was like. You mentioned the Depression and that your family didn't have a lot. Were you aware of that, or was that kind of out of sight, out of mind?
I was aware of it because we had to do things to save money because you didn't have any. Used to go down to the coal yard there where the railroad ties were thrown, and my father and I would pick up railroad ties, take them home, saw them, and use them in the furnace. But that's all you could do. You know, empty the ashes out of the furnace, throw them, your driveway was ashes, and that's it. Went to school. You just got along with kids in the neighborhood, playing tag or whatever, and nothing that should cost any money because you didn't have it.
How about food? Did you always have enough to eat?
Yeah, but it would be like lentils or pasta or something like that. If you make 20 bucks a week and go to a grocery store, what are you going to buy? You know, all right, things were a lot cheaper, but I don't know how they did it with five kids.
Yeah, and you were the second of those five kids. How'd you get along with all your siblings?
Oh, good. Yeah, we did good. Older sister took up tap dancing, and so did I. We used to practice in the house and do dances at the schools and different restaurants. My mother played the piano, so kept busy that way. But it was fun. Of course, at the time, you don't realize what you're going through because that's all you know. You don't know that there's other things out there, so you got along. Fixed bicycles for 10 cents a piece or something just to pick up a dime because the dime at that time was a lot of money.
You mentioned the tap dancing. Is that something you continued later in life?
No, I went in the service and got out, no.
Well, and in those childhood years, I know that's a long time ago we're talking about, but do you remember ever having kind of a dream, an ambition, that thought of, hey, when I grow up, this is who I want to be or what I want to do?
Not really, no, because at the time we just didn't know. Did a lot of ice skating during the winters there, and when we were young, and that I kept up. Even after the war was over, I sent my mother a letter, sent me my ice skates, because we went to Berlin for occupation. I got a job in the kitchen your time off was your own. So I was skating in Berlin. Back to my 90th birthday, I had an ice skating party in Darien.
And you laced him up?
Yep, and I skated.
Well, everyone's wondering, well, did he stay up? Did he stay on his skates, or did he go down?
No, I was up. I haven't fell on skates in years. I would have done it on my 95th birthday, but my daughter would have had a fit.
Well, I guess I'll ask the question now. I mean, it's not too long till you hit the century mark. You think 100 would be worthy of lacing him up one more time?
I don't know if I can. I still have the skates. I got them since I was 14 years old. Uh-huh. They're racers.
And is that something you skated, or did you try hockey too? Or
no, just racing. Yeah.
And I may ask a question that's irrelevant or doesn't make a lot of sense. And back then, even if you're close to something, you're pretty far away. But right now, this part of the country is pretty excited about something going on in the Bronx with a baseball player. And I'm wondering if way back then, were you paying attention to the Yankees and baseball and all that?
I've been going for the Yankees since 1936. I remember when Phil Rizzuto first came up, and I've been a Yankee fan ever since.
Did you ever get to go into the city to Yankee Stadium as a boy?
Oh, yeah. But then it was like 75 cents. Now you can't even, the beer is what, $8?
Yeah. Exactly, that's good. Did you have a Yankee who was your favorite, the guy that you enjoyed watching or rooting for the most?
Joe DiMaggio.
I had a feeling you'd say that. For people who never got to see him in person or live through that era, what was it that was so magical about him?
Well, he was a perfect gentleman. You never heard anything bad about him. And when he played to the fullest of his ability. He's not one of these guys that hit the ball, if it's going to be caught, just trot down to first. He ran. And he often said, when asked why he plays so hard, he says, I do that because there may be fans in the stadium that have never seen him play. And that's how he was a good person.
I guess I have to ask you, since you're still following him, and you have been since 1936, what do you think of that guy in pinstripes now wearing number 99?
I think he's great. I'm glad he got to 61. He was under a lot of pressure, and he's a good person, and he's doing it without any steroids.
And so many of the Yankees from that era would end up like you in the service in the war. I mean, Yogi Berra is one of them who was over there. Can you compare what baseball and the Yankees meant back then to the way it is now? Do you see a difference?
Well, there was a difference because you were more in tune with the leagues. There was only two leagues then. We used to know every player in both leagues, their batting averages. But today, you don't even know the players. Put a game on, it's a team you've been going for. You have to look it up, see who these guys are.
Because it changes so frequently?
Yeah.
So you mentioned that when you were 16, you had to drop out of school to work so you could help feed your family with the five kids. Everyone's hearing that in the context of 2022, and some teenager might say, well, I don't want to do that. How did you feel about that then?
Well, I didn't mind. I mean, something that had to be done. You wanted to finish school, but I never finished high school. I did 2010. I graduated here. When the principal heard that I never graduated, he was well into the veterans, so he got a called state. Then he called me and said, well, be at the gym June something. We have a cap and gown for you.
What did that mean to you all those years later to have them do that for you?
Well, I thought it was great because the ceremony was great. We led the whole parade of all the graduates going out to the football field, and it was great.
You know, and usually I ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, and we can talk about that too. But being out here on the East Coast, it seems like there was more of an awareness of the war before America was in the war, with ships being sunk just off the coast and all that. What was your awareness of what was happening in the world?
Well, when that happened, I was only 15. I figured, well, the war's going to be over before I'm 18. But evidently it wasn't. And with war, there are no winners. One country may lose less than the other, but nobody wins. And it's hard for a lot of people to understand that.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way. So you said, you know, you figured the war would be over before You became a part of it. Did you notice things changing around Stanford, though, after that? Did you notice anything different?
Well, yeah. More people were being drafted and then volunteering to get in. And there was less men around and boys. And the factories were starting to get busy and doing things for the war effort instead of making razors or Yellowtown making locks, and things were going towards the war effort.
And did you think about, were you thinking about joining the service before they drafted you, or were you just busy doing what you were doing?
No, I never thought of joining, just working away. And when they drafted me, I had to go. We didn't have a choice. All they wanted was infantrymen then. I'm glad I wasn't any older, otherwise I'd been D-Day. I was in basic when D-Day happened.
You were in basic training when D-Day happened. And I'm always fascinated by those kind of stories because it hits everyone different and everyone's got a little different background. What was it like once you were drafted and you got into the Army? Were there some moments that kind of felt like, hey, you're in the Army now? This is what it's really going to be like?
Yeah, well, you never knew what it was going to be. But all I did was follow the orders. Whatever they told us to do, that's what I did. But I don't know if that was smart or not. I never... shirked away from anything. In fact, following orders. And one day in combat, my buddy and I were up on a hill firing at the Germans. We had a 60-millimeter mortar, and they had on another hill firing at us. But they were getting much closer to us because they had better weapons. So it got to be that they were so close. My buddy Charlie, he took off and left me up there alone. And me, I'm still staying there. And then finally the sergeant said, Gallo, get the hell out of there. But that's what I did. I followed orders and probably wasn't the smartest thing to do.
But you're still here, so you must have done something right. And I want to hear more about your experience with the mortar and in combat and all that. But I'm just wondering what it was like to say goodbye to your family and head overseas. And you gave us a feel for the timeline, how quickly this progressed.
Well, it was sad to go, but as I say, we didn't have a choice. You don't want to leave the family, and they certainly didn't want me to go. But even my mother, from what I understand, when she got the letter, of course, it was telling the Bronze Star, but she got a letter from the War Department. My younger sister said she wouldn't open it because she figured it was some wounded or dead or something. So my sister, when she came home from school, said, "No, you have to open it." And she opened it finally, and it was because of the Bronze Star.
And we're going to hear the story behind that Bronze Star, but that illustrates what a lot of parents went through during World War II, wondering if their boys would come home. And here's another question for you. Had you ever in your life been on a ship before when they sent you overseas?
No.
So what was that like?
We were sick most of the time because we went over in a convoy. It took 14 days to get to England. It was rough seas. Of course, they had going back and forth with the convoy. It shouldn't take that long, but 14 days.
They were zigzagging to avoid submarines?
Yeah.
Well, and I know this is a long time ago, and it might not be easy to remember this, but I'm always interested to know what your mindset was. I mean, some guys say they weren't worried. They knew they were going to come home no matter what. Other guys were scared out of their minds. Other guys were too sick to think about it because, the ocean. What do you think your mindset or your outlook was then?
Well, I thought that I would be coming home, but you didn't know what you're getting into. I mean, you're going overseas, but you never had that experience, so you really didn't know what was going on. You just assumed that you go in there and the war would be over and you go home, not knowing.
And had you already been assigned to the 78th Division when you went over, or did that happen? You were, okay. So you were going over with guys that you would end up serving with?
Yeah, but during combat, I never thought I'd get back home.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that, and I want to hear more about it. Where did they bring you ashore, and where'd you go from there?
Well, when we went to England, we ended up in Bournemouth, which is the Miami Beach of England, but I couldn't tell with all barbed wire on the shore and all. So after that, when we went to across the channel, we ended in France, but that was after D-Day. So we ended up going to France and to Belgium. Our first day in combat was in the Hurricane Forest, which was December 13th. And that was the coldest winter they ever had. Guys were getting frostbite right away the first day. Then the bulge started at just about then. So we ended up in part of the bulge. But the Germans didn't want to fight any more than we did. I used to see dead Germans, but I never said, another dead kraut. I would think a letter going home to that man's wife, mother, sister, or somebody. The same as any of our guys did.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old Frank Gallo of New Canaan, Connecticut, including his memories of his 19th birthday when he says he wasn't sure if he would live to see 20. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you'll find photos and a little video of Frank inside the home that he and his late wife Viola built way back in 1954. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this visit in New Canaan, Connecticut with 96-year-old Frank Gallo, who was the Grand Marshal of New Canaan's Veterans Day Parade a few years ago and who continues to give back to his community. In his basement, he has an immaculate wood shop that he stays pretty busy in. During the pandemic, he busted out his sewing machine and made over 700 masks for a retirement home nearby. But back in World War II, Frank was just a teenager, manning 60-millimeter mortars with the 78th Infantry Division's 310th Regiment.
We were with the riflemen. As far as where you slept on the ground or in the snow. Being it was so cold, if it was in snow, you dug out enough of a slit trench for two guys to lay down and hug each other for body heat. Because we didn't have the equipment and coats like the Germans had. You didn't have a change of underwear. If you went through water and you got soaked, you wore the same socks, same underwear, maybe for a month.
And I want to get some perspective on that. So, I mean, growing up in Connecticut, you know what winter conditions are like, right? You've dealt with plenty of snow. You talked about your love of ice skating. But how much colder was it there in the Hurkin Forest and in the Ardennes in 1944?
Well, it was colder, I thought, but being that you're outside all the time, it was much colder.
Did you deal with any frozen toes or fingers or anything?
No, a lot of other guys did, yeah.
How did you avoid it?
I don't know. Fate.
Well, and you mentioned that your first combat was December 13th in the Hurkin Forest. This is just a few days before the Battle of the Bulge officially begins. But you've never been in combat before. What was that like? What was the first impression?
When we hit the forest and heard the guns firing at us, I cried. You think you're a big deal when you're 18. In real life, you're a big deal. Ma, what do you know? In combat, you're nothing but a baby. And I don't even... I'm not afraid to admit I cried. Ma, where are you? You know? And I think mothers had the toughest job of all. They're sitting home not knowing where their sons are, if they're alive or dead. What that must have been for mothers to go through. That'd be terrible.
You're giving us some real powerful perspective here on what it was really like. And if there's anything you're not comfortable talking about, don't feel pressured. But when you say that, you know, that first night you cried, What was it that made you cry? What were you seeing or hearing or facing that brought you to that point?
People shooting at you, bombs dropping, and you're just afraid. But after that, you get over it. You're always afraid. If you're not afraid, you're going to die, you know, because then you become careless.
And, you know, most people listening have never operated a 60-millimeter mortar before. Can you walk us through in real, you know, basic terms how you did your job, what you had to do or consider or, you know, go through?
Well, in the mortar squad, you had the leader, the second in command, which they operated the mortar. And then you had three ammo bearers. The mortar came apart, the base plate came apart, but you never took it apart. You carried it that way. So the riflemen were right with us. They were right in front of us. You set the mortar down. You had to adjust the how far you wanted to go, and you had to be careful not to hit your own men. And once it was set up, the sergeant would see where it was going and tell you, come back a little, and different angles. And the second gunner would, he's the one that would pull the charges off the ammo and drop them in.
And so where were you as part of that equation?
Well, I was either the gunner or the second gunner most of the time. But you had to carry it, I mean, because it was only that tall. I mean, it still weighed, but you had to carry it so you can drop it right away.
And how long did it take you to figure out that being near that mortar made you a target?
Well, you didn't have to figure too long. Because even in the forest, you're getting hit with all these shells, and they explode in the trees, and the shrapnel comes down. And you had no place to hide.
Well, yeah, and that's one thing that I've always tried to imagine myself when I talk to guys who went through that like you did. You know, what do you do in a situation like that? You're kind of helpless, right? There's no controlling where a shell's going to hit a tree and stuff goes everywhere. These tree bursts killed a lot of people. So what if that was happening? If incoming artillery or mortars are coming in, what do you do?
Well, you try to get covered as best you can. You hit the ground. But I think a lot of it is fate. On my 19th birthday, I never thought I'd see 20. They had us pinned down in this forest, and it was a big open field between us and the Germans. You couldn't get across that field. Finally, after the order came, march and fire. So everybody had to get up, go across that field, and when we did, the machine guns were firing at us, the 88s from the tanks, the mortars, everything. I dove into a crater. My feet were sticking out, and I prayed. I never thought I'd see 20, but evidently I got through it. I don't know how, but I think it's just fate. God was looking out for us.
Yeah, and where was that?
Well, we were trying to take the Schmanuel Dam, which was in, I forget, Schmidt was the name of the town, because they were set to blow the dam, and a lot of people would have got drowned. So we got through it. We finally took the town and saved the dam. I don't know how, you know.
Yeah, and so this is your 19th birthday, February of 45. And if you were back in the States, your mom and your sisters, your family would be celebrating with you. Instead, you're getting that command, march and fire. So how do you process that? Because you know what's out there, right?
I know. You don't. You can't think about that. You know, you just get up and go and hope that you don't get hit.
And by that time, you'd been through a lot, too. And I know we're kind of bouncing back and forth here chronologically. But, you know, during December, the Hürtgen Forest and the Battle of the Bulge and where you guys were going, I've talked to a lot of guys who've mentioned how cold it was and all that. And you said you're sleeping outdoors. But as those days pile up, and these are your first days of combat, did it feel like it was lasting forever? Was it going by quickly? What was it like to be in the middle of that?
Seems like it was never going to end, but you just went day by day, hoping you didn't get hit. I had another close call. Our outfit was the first foot troops across the Rhine River at Remagen. What happened, the 9th Armored Division happened to get there not thinking there would be any bridges left, and the Ludendorff Bridge was still intact, which was a railroad bridge. So once they found that, 78th was close by, so the command called the 78th to get up there quick. So they trucked us up there. We went across the 9th Armored Division with the tanks went. We were right behind them. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and they failed to blow that bridge. I don't know if it's because they got drunk or what, But once we got across, they tried everything. And when it got daylight, they were sending planes over. But after that day, that night, we took another town. And it got dark. And the sergeant says, well, we have to set up a front line there. But one of you guys could go down and see if you could find a bed in town and sleep. The other stays on the front line. So I flipped the coin with my buddy. I lost. So he was able to go down, find a bed. I stayed on the front line all night. And in the morning, I'm waiting for him to come up. I said, Sarge, where's Wheeler? He's supposed to come up. He got killed on the way down. He won the toss and lost his life. To me, that's fate.
I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You know, and you're an 18-year-old kid, halfway around the world from your family. And then, of course, right in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge, here comes Christmas. Do you remember that Christmas, 1944?
Yep. We were holed up in a cellar of an old house. That German laying in the driveway. We had to go on the front line. We had 2 hours on and 2 hours off. I remember sitting in that cellar playing the harmonica, playing Christmas carols. Don't ask me when I had the harmonica, because I was used to play it, but I must have brought it with me and kept it. And that Christmas, that's what I did. The 2 hours we were off.
Were any of the other guys joining in?
Well, they were singing, yeah.
So you're playing the harmonica, and they're singing along with you Christmas carols.
Yeah.
With a dead German in the driveway.
Right. We didn't get any gifts.
Again, if there's nothing there, I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head, but I'm just wondering, if there's ever a time since then, when Christmas rolls around, do you think back to that Christmas?
Oh, yeah. All the time. I think back to that 19th birthday, too. How I got to be 96, I don't know. You know, 18, I look at my great-grandson when he was 18, and I'm saying, he couldn't possibly have been drafted. He looks like such a little kid. Were we like that? So, 18, you're so young. And I think it's too early to go into having guys fight.
Yeah, and you were confronted with that all around you. Guys just like you getting killed. You told us about a couple close calls. And you just mentioned your 19th birthday again. And you told me something there, that when you dove into that crater and your feet are sticking up, that you prayed. What do you pray in a moment like that?
You pray that you can get out alive. It's about all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So evidently you heard me.
Evidently so, but you still had a long way to go after that. Yeah. And you made reference to the Bronze Star, that when the letter from the War Department went to your home back here in Connecticut, your mother was afraid to open it, thinking it was bad news, but it was actually saying, no, your son did something really courageous and special that earned him the Bronze Star. What can you tell us about that incident and why you were awarded the Bronze Star?
I really don't know. I guess they have to give Bronze Stars to somebody, so they try to pick out who.
Yeah, I've heard that line before, but I think your group of soldiers was in a situation where the Germans were on both sides of you, right?
Yeah.
So what really happened? You're not bragging. You're just helping us understand what you went through.
Well, I don't know. We just could see the Germans on our left side. They're going around the side, but I didn't think they'd get behind us. But evidently, Sergeant said they were behind us, so we automatically turned toward the rear, start dropping shells. Evidently, it helped. But the machine gunners were trying to get up the hill and go over the hill to take the objective, which I don't know what it was at the time. Because you don't know what's going on. I mean, they're telling you, well, we got to go here or there.
But if you hadn't done that, if your mortar shells hadn't been able to repel the Germans on that side, then a whole lot of people could have lost their lives.
Yeah, it would have been bad if they got behind us, yeah.
Is there something that you look back on and you say, well, that was the most challenging, most difficult aspect of what you were doing in the war?
Well, I think that marching fire was the worst.
Because they're basically saying, hey, go take your chance. There's nothing to help you.
If you can picture a couple of football fields, now you got to go from one end to the other. There's not a tree or nothing in between. With somebody shooting at you and dropping bombs on you, what it's like. I mean, you ran and you zigzagged, but even so. So I don't know.
And if I'm wrong, correct me, but I'm just imagining that as you do that, you're seeing or becoming aware of other guys around you that are getting hit, right?
Oh, yeah. But you just keep going, you know.
And I've heard a lot of different perspectives on this. When it comes to casualties, guys you've served with getting hit, is that something that you found a way to deal with over time? Did it get a little easier to handle or process?
Well, I guess it was part of the deal. Naturally, you didn't like to lose anybody, but you're just glad it's not you.
And you gave us a hint of, you know, the significance of your regiment. The 310th was the first regiment to cross the Rhine River on foot at the Ludendorff Bridge in Remagen. You probably didn't know at the time how significant that would be or that people were still talking about it. But at 4 a.m, I'm guessing that's pretty dark, right? What was it like crossing that bridge?
It was bad because there was holes in the bridge. It was a railroad bridge, hoping you didn't fall through. They made a movie on that. But I saw that movie, but I said they weren't there because it showed when the guys who crossed the bridge. It was daylight, the civilians are all clapping and everything. There were no civilians there, and it was dark. So the movie showed civilians clapping and everything.
And the point about it being dark and holes in the bridge, it's not like you can put a light on it, right? Because then you're telling the enemy, hey, here I am.
Yeah. No.
So that sounds like that was a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and it took them a few days to knock that bridge down. They had the airplanes coming over, and I think it was a few days before they finally got it down. But by that time, the combat engineers had pontoon bridges across.
So if you ever watched that 1969 film, The Bridge at Remagen, starring Robert Vaughn, remember that the filmmakers took a few pretty substantial liberties. And now you know what it was really like from one of the guys who crossed that bridge at 4 a.m. 77 years ago. It's time for our final break, but we'll have more with 96-year-old Frank Gallo of New Canaan, Connecticut. Don't forget to go online for photos and video with Frank. You'll even see the picture that he blows a kiss to every morning when he walks out of his bedroom, a wedding photo of Frank and Viola. You'll find all of that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 96-year-old Frank Gallo of New Canaan, Connecticut. He served with the 78th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II, making it through the Hürtgen Forest and the Battle of the Bulge. When we left off, he had just told us what it was like to cross the Ludendorff Bridge over the Rhine at Remagen. What do you remember about the guys you served with? Did you get very close with them?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have one guy who lived in Jersey. We kept in contact all the time. We went to all the reunions together, and I used to visit him. He was 3 hours from Atlantic City. Yeah, we got very friendly. He came up here. We used to go down there.
When you guys would be at those reunions, what kind of stuff would you talk about?
Well, they would talk. I listened to guys, and that's how I found out we were in the Bulge. I didn't know we were in the Bulge. I saw one of the guys with a patch. I said, what are you doing? Well, we're in the Bulge. Well, you don't know. Nobody's saying, well, this is the Bulge. Right. You know, you hear guys talking. Well, you remember we were in the corner looking around the building there? I don't remember nothing like that. I think they made up a lot of it.
Yeah, everybody's in a different place with a different view. As, you know, your 19th birthday in February, get into March and April. We all know May 8th is VE Day when they finally surrendered. Were there some signs that you saw that told you, hey, we're getting close, this might not last that much longer?
Yeah, it was probably toward the end of April there. The Germans were more or less giving up. You know, they were capturing a lot of guys, and it wasn't as much fighting, so you could see it was coming to an end. But after the war, they were getting us ready to go to the Pacific, which I'm glad the Japanese gave up.
And were you aware at all during this time of the concentration camps or what had been done to the Jewish people and other political prisoners of the Nazi regime?
I mean, after the war, I was aware of it, yeah. But nobody ever told us anything during the war.
Did you guys end up passing through any of those places?
No.
And, you know, with regard to VE Day, do you remember where you were and what that news meant to you?
I'm glad it was over, yeah. But I didn't like that we were getting ready to go to the Pacific.
Yeah, and what does that mean? What did they do with you? Did they send you somewhere for more training, or?
No, wherever we were, they were training us more, but I'm glad it was over there. And that's when I decided, well, get in the kitchen. It was an opening for the kitchen. I could have stayed with the troops, but then you become sergeant, you'd still have to train, and you still have to do duties stuff. And with the kitchen, you work three meals and you're off three meals. Your time is off as your own. So it was like a job. So I'm glad I got that. I wasn't a cook, but I learned.
And when did you get to come home?
April of 46.
So you were there in occupation for almost a year. What kind of stuff was happening during that time? I'm sure you saw some things or met some people that still stay in your memory.
We had German KPs stuff to help in. And you met a lot of people. In Berlin, a lot of the Germans spoke English. In the smaller towns, they didn't. So it was a lot easier then.
And so you had German prisoners working for you in the kitchen?
Yeah.
How'd you get along?
All right. Yeah. As I say, they didn't want to fight either any more than we did.
Do you have an idea? This is a long time ago, right? Most of the people who are going to hear this weren't alive during World War II. Why does it still matter? Why should we be aware of what happened then and what you and 16 million other Americans in uniform did?
Well, because I think we did something at the time to save the country. But when I look back and the way the country is today, I think we wasted our time. Because in such state of affairs today, I don't know what happened.
Is there something that you look back on that maybe characterized that time period or that generation during World War II that maybe we'd do well to learn from today?
Well, I don't know how to say it, but I think at that time, everybody that went in the service had a reason to be there and had a dedication to what they wanted to do and hoped that the country would come out of it better. And all those women that went to work helping the cause, it was something that should be brought up today where they think the same way, and they don't. I have to laugh at we lose power today, and all you see in the paper, oh, gee, I was out of power for 2 days. They don't realize they had a roof over their head. They had clothes to wear. They had food to eat. They don't realize the GIs had no power. They just lived outside. They had no clothes to change. They couldn't say, wait, I have to go to the bathroom. There were no bathrooms. They don't realize what the guys went through. And to complain because they lost power for 2 days, I have to laugh.
Well, you're putting it in perspective. You're helping us out. What was it like to come back home, to see your family again, to see America again?
It was great. Yeah. I was glad to be back and glad to be back in the family and doing things that we wanted to do. Took a year off, didn't go to work.
Did you sail into New York?
Yeah.
Again, not trying to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but a lot of the guys who came into New York have mentioned seeing the Statue of Liberty.
We saw it when we went out. We saw it when we come back. It was something you always wanted to see. I never did till I went in the service. And it was really a meaning to come back and see it.
That's what I was wondering, if it felt different coming back than going out.
Yes, because you never thought you'd see it coming back.
And then you had a life in front of you. Did you meet your Your wife after that?
Yeah, I met her in the end of 46 on a blind date. And we went 3 years and got married in 1950.
A blind date? How'd that get set up?
Well, I knew a friend that lived next door to a girl that went to school with my wife, and they put it together. So the blind date that worked out.
Yeah, I guess they knew what they were doing, huh? Yeah. And we're sitting in a home that you and your wife built with your own hands.
Yeah, yeah, I have a video of my wife on the roof hammering the shingles, and yeah.
And working specifically with wood is something you've been doing most of your life?
As a hobby, yeah. I made my dining room set before I got married, even.
And you're still doing stuff like that?
Not big things. I do a lot of scroll work.
Something tells me there's a few people in Connecticut that have some of the stuff you've made.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I never sold anything. I always used it for gifts, and housewarming, stuff like that.
Is there a particular item you've made that maybe you took the most pride in or felt like, hey, I did a really nice job on this one?
I don't know. I made something religious for and it's in the church even. I have one here. I'll get it.
So what you have here is a cross with angels on all sides of it, and it looks like you could snap an angel into place here or there, but you've carved this all out of one piece of wood.
Yes, with the scroll saw. It takes a lot of time to get all these little parts there.
And you still have all your fingers?
Yeah, so far.
So you have one of these in your home here, but you also decided to give one to your local parish here?
Yeah, I gave one to him, and I gave one to the church in Saugatuck, because he was a pastor here, and then he got a job in a different church.
So if someone is at St. Aloysius here in New Canaan, they can look up on the wall and see one of these?
Yes, when you go in the office on the wall.
And it'll still be hanging there when you're ice skating on your 100th birthday and maybe a long time after that, huh?
I think so.
Just trying to think if there's anything I've left out. And I know you're a very humble guy and you went through a lot in the war. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that when you think back, you think it's important to mention?
Not that I could think of.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story as only you could. I'm always fascinated to learn. Is there something, when you think back on all this, and it's clear you have, you've thought about this a lot over the years. It's not something you can forget about. Is there something, when you think back on it, that you would say you're most proud of or that you're most thankful for?
I don't have any one thing that I could say, you know, just that I'm glad that I was able to serve and come back alive.
What is it that keeps you going now? Because, I mean, you're 96, you're still doing woodworking, you're still driving, you're impeccably dressed, your tie is perfect with the knot right there. I wish I could tie a knot like that. I'm sure you get asked this a lot. What's your secret to staying so sharp and with it and youthful?
Well, I walk every day. I'm in with the human services. They have Fitbit. I try to do 7,000 steps a day, which I do every day. And then I eat normal, watch my weight, but it's no fun living alone. Do everything, wash clothes, cook. I do get Meals on Wheels 3 times a week. That helps. But I cook for my daughter sometimes because she's too busy and she's a vegetarian. And I go out every morning to Burger King for coffee. To sit home and eat by yourself, it's no fun. And you meet some nice people there. I mean, a lot of people think fast food place, all you get is derelicts, and you meet some nice people there. I met this one woman born in Italy, and she lost her husband 10 years ago. She's an artist, and we got pretty friendly, and she had problems. So I was driving her to the doctor and stuff. And there's about 4 widows that I watch over. They have a problem, this doesn't work or that one, I go down and help them out.
Kind of sounds like you're saying what keeps you young and energetic is you still have a lot of purpose in your life.
Yeah, but lately I've been wondering what sense of even getting out of bed, you know. When you're laying in bed, you're safe, nothing's happening. And you got to get up and face the world. And just some of the things you see out there, it's pathetic. Politicians, they don't care anything about the country. They care about themselves.
Wonder if their perspective might be different if they had spent a few nights in a frozen foxhole in the bulge.
I think it would. Harold N. Blumenthal say he was in Vietnam? Never was.
Thanks for being patient with me. I'm just wondering maybe one more question. What kind of advice would you have for young people today? I mean, you mentioned your great-grandson looking at him when he's 18 and the contrast between when you were 18 and pondering that. But for young people today who might be listening to this, what's the best advice you could share?
Honor your mother and father and listen to them and do things that should help other people and not only things for yourself. That's all I could say. These kids, the way they're brought up today, they have to have every digital thing that's out there. And they don't want it for long, because when the new one comes out before the end of the year, I got to have that one. No patience. And it's a shame they don't understand what life is about. I still pick up pennies I see in the street, and these kids throw things away. But I don't know if you can blame them, because they don't know any better.
Well, that makes me wonder what you would say is the most important thing your parents taught you.
That to watch what you're doing, be careful, any money you have, be friendly to all your neighbors or whatever, and do the best you can no matter what you're doing. And that's what we did when we went to school. That's about it.
That's about it. And that's just about right, isn't it? Frank Gallo, 96 years young. And before we sign off, let's hear very quickly from the retired Army colonel who let us know about Frank and his unique story.
My name's Don Carmel, and I've known Frank Gallo for several years. I met him at the VFW in New Canaan, and all I have to say about him is he's one of the most humble persons you'll ever meet in your life, and he's religious, and he's just a truly honorable person. That's all.
Was there something you heard him say in describing his World War II experiences or just his life that really grabbed you or made an impact on you?
It's not so much that. He doesn't talk about it. And when prompted, you could see his humility and where it's like, you know, I don't want to brag about things. And so your interview today is really special because it's the first time I've ever heard him, you know, actually talk about his experiences. And it reminds me of my dad, who served in the Second World War II, who never spoke about any of this until late in life when I kept prodding him and he'd talk a little bit here and there, but he's the same, the same repertoire.
The same can be said of so many of the World War II veterans we've had the privilege of meeting here on Hometown Heroes. Another layer of why Tom Brokaw labeled them all with that apt moniker that has really endured, the greatest generation indeed. Thanks to Don and to Frank, and thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.